أعوذ بالله من الشيطان الرجيم بسم الله الرحمن الرحيم ربي اشرح لي صدري ويسر لي امري واحلل عقدة من لساني يفقهوا قولي. My dear elders, brothers and sisters, salamun alaikum. Last week we spoke about three amazing scholarly personalities. We spoke about Sheikh Tusi, we spoke about Allama Hilli, and we spoke about Allama Majlisi. We said that Sheikh Tusi was the founder of the Hawza in Najaf after he fled Baghdad, which was previously a center of learning. We spoke about how his house was burned down, how his library was burned down, and how he found sanctuary in Najaf. And until today, the seminary in Najaf is flourishing. We talked about how he worked in all areas, in jurisprudence, in imamat, in tafsir, in ilm rijal, in ahadith, etc. In fact, two of the Kutubul Arba, the most significant books of ahadith, are written by Sheikh Tusi. And we wrote how he was one of the founders, or if not the founder, of the concept of ijtihad and marja'iyah through his book An-Nihaya, which is the first form of risala, the first time a scholar wrote, in my opinion, rather than purely showing ahadith. We say that he was one of the most significant scholars during the period of the Ghaiba. And that is why he's known as Sheikh of the sect, Sheikh al-Taifa. Then we spoke about Allama Hilli, how he was a child prodigy. At the age of 6, he became a leading scholar. At the age of 11, Allama Hilli was a mujtahid. We spoke about how Allama Hilli brought Shiaism to Iran by solving the marriage problem of the Sultan of the time. And despite being called a Rafida by the Hanbali and the Shafi and the Hanafi and the Maliki, it was Allama Hilli who found Shiaism in Iran. And we spoke about how his works were so amazing, 500 works. And we went into a little bit of depth about his book Minhajul Karama and the reply by the Wahhabi scholar Sheikh Ibn Taymiyyah, which was Minhajul Sunnah. We spoke about how the fact that him and his maternal uncle, Muhakkik al-Hilli, were the first two formal mujtahideen of our Shia madhab during the occultation of our 12th Imam. And then lastly, we spoke a little bit about Allama Majlisi, his wonderful book in Biharul Anwar, all 110 volumes, and how Allama Majlisi steered Shiaism away from Sufism, away from the mix, and created a demarcation in the religion to which is there until now. In the 20th century, we have also seen some truly wonderful scholars. Scholars like Allama Muhammad Hussein Tabattabai, who in Qum provided great intellectual benefit to our madhab. For example, he wrote 20 volumes, Tafsirul Quran, which was known as Tafsirul Mizan. And he was very strong at philosophy. We can talk about in the 20th century, Ayatollah Mohsin al-Hakim, who was one of the first global maraja for mukallids living all over the world, whose focus was on building Husseiniyas and Imam in the West, in Africa, etc. Or we could talk about Ayatollah Behjat, whose spirituality, whose lifestyle, whose humility and whose humbleness is unparalleled. But there is one scholar who has all of these facets. One scholar who we could argue is the greatest scholar of the 20th century, if not the greatest scholar throughout the whole period of the Ghaiba. And that is none other than Ayatollah Al-Udhma Sayyid Abul Qasim Al-Khoi. And he is known by many as being the doyen, i.e. the pearl, i.e. the one who is unparalleled among scholars. So what was his legacy? Who is this Ayatollah Al-Khoi? I hope this... isn't working, but if we can go to the next slide. Ayatollah Al-Khoi was born on the 19th of November, 1899, in the city of Khoi, which is West Azerbaijan, but part of Iran at the time. He moved to Najaf at the age of 13 and began studying Shia theology. There were few scholars of his level. In fact, there are no scholars I can see history of who, before they became a marja, others had dreams about of his level. I won't go into the dreams now. Suffice to say that Ayatollah Al-Khoi also had a dream about himself when he was a very young student in Najaf, about how one day he would be wonderful. And others had as well. Others saw dreams of the 12th Imam appearing in their dream, explaining that this wonderful marja, Sayyid Abul Qasim Al-Khoi, would come ahead of them. I won't go into them now because we will be short of time. Ayatollah Al-Khoi studied under very notable scholars. Scholars like Ayatollah Isfahani, Ayatollah Naini, Ayatollah Araki, and of course Ayatollah Sayyid Mohsin al-Hakim. Ayatollah Khoi once described his scholars. He said, "I've learned from each and one of them a complete course in the science of Usul and digested from them in the science of fiqh. I was one of a few who would critique the research of these scholars who specialized in these branch of knowledge. Al-Naini was my last mentor, and I used to accompany him more frequently than anyone else." Ayatollah Khoi became a mujtahid at the age of 20. In his late 20s, about 25 to 27. In 1971, when Ayatollah Mohsin al-Hakim passed away, Ayatollah Khoi became the Maraja, the global Maraja. And at the time, there were other more established scholars, scholars who were better known, scholars who had studied longer. But they all decided that Ayatollah al-Khoi would be the Maraja, and this is due to his intellectual knowledge, recognized by his own peers. Very quickly, if we go into his works, I don't want to go into too much detail on it because we have so much to cover on his life. But in all, he had 90 significant pieces of work. The one to really pick out of all of them, which are all very, very deep and used today, the key one is Muajjam Rijal al-Hadith, which without doubt and no exaggeration at all is the most useful book today on Ilmu Rijal. It has 24 volumes, includes profiles of 15,676 narrators of ahadith. So it was significant work, especially significant when it talks about the narrators of the Kutubul Arba as well. Interestingly enough, and this is a charge made against Marja'iyya, that our Maraji do not change their opinions. Once they give an edict, they stick by it. Well, this is quite false. Many times Ayatollah Khoi was challenged to change his fatwa. For example, he was challenged on his book Kamilu Ziyarat, and he changed it based on the viewpoints of his students. So many a times his students would give him opinions, give him viewpoints, and he was open-minded enough to change his mind. Very, very different if you look at all religions of main scholars. One of Ayatollah Khoi's legacies are the level of students that he left. Very few Maraji of the 20th century can boast that this level of students have been left. When Ayatollah al-Hakim passed away, Ayatollah Khoi gained the administration of the Najaf Hawza, and he brought it up to about 8,000 students at its peak. Let's look at an example of Dars-e Kharij. Dars-e Kharij is given by somebody who is a mujtahid to students of a very high caliber. And often to prepare for one Dars-e Kharij, it would take maybe 18 hours, maybe 20 hours, maybe a couple of days. Ayatollah al-Khoi held 4 Dars-e Kharij commonly a day. He was able to give pages and pages of information on all his fatwa and ask for challenges. He used to go into his Dars-e Kharij and tell his students like Ayatollah Sistani, Ayatollah Ishaq Fayyad, Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir Sadr, he used to tell them, "Come and challenge me. Come and challenge me on my fatwa." And they were all quite anxious to be in front of such a knowledgeable personality. His students include Ayatollah Sistani, Ayatollah Mirza Jawad Tabrizi, Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, Ayatollah Mahdi al-Hakim, Ayatollah Fadhallah, Imam Musa al-Sadr, Ayatollah Baharul Ulum, Ayatollah Behesti, Ayatollah Mohsini, who is running a wonderful hawza today just outside Kabul in Afghanistan, Ayatollah Bashir Najafi, Ayatollah Wahid Khorastani, Ayatollah Ishaq Fayyad, Ayatollah Muhammad Taqi Bahjat, Ayatollah Khomeini. I could continue. Almost 150 students have studied under Ayatollah Khoi of extreme caliber. His students used to call him Ustad, and there's a lot of things written about Ayatollah Khoi from his students. So for example, Sheikh Mughniyah writes, "He was like the sun that sends its rays everywhere, all the time. He was the pivot around which the motion of scholarship revolved, and to whom the Hawza is indebted for appreciation and loyalty. His was the golden age." Sayyid Sistani writes and says today, "He is the sun whose light continues to guide us." Ayatollah Ishaq Fayyaz said, has written a whole chapter in favor of Al-Khoi, and he says, "Today the Najaf Hawza's prosperity is due and its thawab goes to the soul of Ayatollah Al-Khoi." His students held him in such amazing standing. But if we look at the achievements of Ayatollah Al-Khoi, we would only really understand his legacy if we understood the oppression that the Ba'athist regime put him under, and why and what he did to protect the seminary. Abbas Kazim, who has written a book very recently called The Hawza Under Siege, has analyzed 10 million Ba'athist documents. Now, the Ba'athists, the way they ran Iraq was every decision, every meeting, the minutes were written, every recommendation was written, everything was put into writings. So 10 million documents have been gathered. Today, they're held at the Stanford University's Hoover Institute. And these documents give us and gave Abbas Kadhim a good introduction into the structure of the Ba'ath Party, how they made decision, what atrocities they committed. And it is really interesting of the way they viewed the Hoza and the way they viewed the threat of Ayatollah Al-Khoi. The first person to do a study on behalf of Saddam was Izzat Ad-Duri, who was Saddam's closest advisor and one of his deputies. And Izzat Ad-Duri's report on the Hoza looked at 3 points. He looked at number one, could Ayatollah Al-Khoi be expelled from Iraq? And can the Hoza be closed? Secondly, could a Ba'athist, Arab nationalist, Shia replacement be groomed who could take over the Hoza and remove Ayatollah Al-Khoi? And thirdly, could the Hoza come under the state and what steps were necessary to close them off? And so a lot of debate happened within the Ba'athists between 1983 and 1988. And they did their level best to push Khoi out of Najaf and push him either to Qom or to Lebanon or to wherever, but they wanted him out of Iraq. And Ayatollah Al-Khoi was once asked by someone, why are you resisting leaving Najaf? Why not go to Qom, where there is already a center of learning and soon to be a Shia government? And Ayatollah Al-Khoi's response is that 1,000 or so years of work from the great Sheikh Tushtizi will now perish. The Najaf Hoza is today the backbone of our madhab. And if we want to see, and if we say that Sheikh Tusi was great in finding the Najaf and founding the Najaf Hoza, then Ayatollah is as great for maintaining, developing, and nurturing it. Saddam Hussein was frustrated, very, very, very frustrated at Ayatollah Al-Khoi. And he could not expel him, so then later on he personally writes a policy called containment of Khoi. And this policy of containment, Saddam and Izzat spell out as being number one, extreme pressure on Ayatollah Al-Khoi and his representatives, including periods of house arrest. Secondly, surveillance of the Hoza, including infiltration of the Hoza at junior levels. Thirdly, the continual execution of Khoi's associates. Fourthly, prohibition of teaching in Farsi. The Ba'athists were very insecure about Farsi. And fifthly, the deportation of foreign students. The report writes that Saddam wanted to, in comments, compel Al-Khoi to declare his unambiguous position towards Khomeini. He wanted Khoi to write a fatwa against Khomeini. And he even writes, the report writes, that the party, i.e. the Ba'athist party, was working on promoting Arab elements inside the Hoza to ensure that an Arab sympathetic to the Ba'athists would take over the Hoza. But in the same report, they later conclude that it would be impossible for someone to emulate Ayatollah Al-Khoi. It would take 20 years, if not more. And so it was impossible to infiltrate the Hoza at the highest level. But Saddam and the Ba'athists made the Hoza life very, very difficult. There were 8,000 students when Ayatollah Mohsen Al-Hakim was there, only 200 at the peak of the Ba'athist regime. 12 institutes were there in Najaf when Ayatollah Mohsen Al-Hakim was there, only 2 when Ayatollah Al-Khoi was there. Saddam wanted to make sure, and his policy read, to contain these schools and completely end their role gradually by opening other schools as much as possible and taking them away from Ayatollah Al-Khoi. So one of the threats to Ayatollah Al-Khoi's Hoza that he was running was infiltration. And this was something that Saddam put a lot of effort in. He writes, the special emphasis without doubt is the aim of advancing and selecting Shia members of the Ba'ath Party to join the Hoza, disguised as students in the normal course of religion, and to later cultivate them and ascend the Hoza leadership. 12 candidates were identified, but there is no evidence at all that they managed to infiltrate the Hoza at all. Saddam not only wanted to infiltrate the Hoza or corrupt the Hoza, his policy was also to monitor and attack Ayatollah Khoi's wakils. He had a list drawn up by Izzat of who were Ayatollah Al-Khoi's hostile wakils. Historians today, when you read the biography of Ayatollah Al-Khoi, they will tell you Ayatollah Al-Khoi was a quietist. They say the same about Sayyid Sistani, same about Ayatollah Ishaq Fayaz. They say that they were under quietism. But the question is, how do you define quietism? Whilst Ayatollah Al-Khoi did not ask people to take up arms against Saddam, he was totally against the corrupt regime. He may not have called for a revolution, but he was defiant against Saddam. There are many, many examples of this. One example is where Izzat Ad-Duri visits Ayatollah Khomeini and asks for his support in one of Saddam's wars. Ayatollah Khomeini replies very categorically, "I will not change my opinion nor do anything you force me to do. You better kill me. If you kill me, I will become a martyr and you will be cursed for killing an old man like me." Examples of Ayatollah Khomeini standing are there. After the Kuwait war, a lot of looting took place. A lot of people took back cars. A lot of people took back other belongings. There were many people who took back Mercedes S-classes from Kuwait. And Ayatollah Khomeini gave a fatwa reminding people that this was stolen items. And those Iraqis will know that the place was left with cars. There was no one that would buy these S-classes and these Mercedes because Ayatollah Khomeini had given a very clear fatwa that they were stolen. That was his standing amongst the Shia. That is why Saddam was so clear in oppressing him. And you can imagine, during this oppression, he writes 90 works. He runs 4 Dars-e Kharij a day. He does so much excellent work in grooming his students. This is one letter which I found in the archives of the World Federation from the Medical Advisory Board asking or pleading for to the Red Cross for help in Ayatollah Al-Khomeini when he was missing at one point. There are many, many such archives which are being gathered by the World Federation. Saddam did not systematically only attack the Hoza. He wanted to expel it, but Ayatollah Al-Khomeini maintained it throughout his lifetime. After the Shia uprising in 1991, Ayatollah Al-Khomeini was arrested and imprisoned. Some 105 people connected to Ayatollah Al-Khomeini were also arrested, and many did not make it back. One onlooker saw the arrest of Ayatollah Al-Khomeini, and he writes, "I watched from a nearby house, and some soldiers captured Imam. 4 members of the leadership went with him. They forced the Imam, over 90 years old, to walk without assistance, causing him to fall repeatedly on the ground." He was imprisoned, later forced to appear on TV with Saddam, very famous, I'm sure a lot of people here will remember it. He was pressurized to give a fatwa in favor of Saddam, but he never wavered. A lot of those close to Ayatollah Al-Khomeini were attacked. Many were killed to show Ayatollah Al-Khomeini that it is time to change his mind, but he never wavered. They even beat him in jail, so much so that he had bruises in his body. And after 3 days, they sent him home and kept him under house arrest. The Iraqi government, this is very interesting historically, were prepared for his death. On the day of the death, they cut off all the telephone lines in Kufa and most of the telephone lines in Najaf. It just happened to be on the same day that his health quickly deteriorated and he had severe swelling in his chest where it became visible. By the time the doctors came, it was too late. Some declared it cardiac failure, others declared it other things. For some reason, it happened to be that the Iraqi army had already deployed a huge number of people nearby and blocked off all the highways between Najaf and Kufa. They moved in to disperse any crowds that were coming throughout Iraq. State TV announced that on Sunday his funeral would take place, but the Baathists at midnight ordered the funeral to take place the following morning. Saturday night, his body was washed. Namaz al-Janazah was recited at the shrine of Imam Ali alayhi salam, which was led by Ayatollah Sistani, under a lot of pressure whilst the Baathist soldiers were surrounding the Janazah. Only 6 people were allowed to bury him. It happened to be the following day that the telephone lines coincidentally began operating again. Although people say it's heart disease, a lot of commentators now say that there is a likelihood that Ayatollah Al-Khomeini was poisoned. Why do they say this? Number one, he left prison only 3 days earlier. He was badly beaten, bruised, threatened by Saddam. Saddam was upset that he didn't speak in favor of the Intifada. Saddam wanted to get rid of Khomeini, could not expel him. He was under house arrest, therefore everything given to Ayatollah Al-Khomeini was controlled. The electricity lines were already cut off. The telephone lines were cut off before this event happened. There was a heavy presence in the area. They blocked off the roads to Kufa. It literally is too much planning for everything to all be a coincidence. In fact, if you look at it, many Iraqi sensitive dissidents were killed through thallium poisoning. And there are many today who would argue that Ayatollah Al-Khomeini is possibly a shaheed. The state argued and said on its TV that a massive funeral took place. Lots of people turned up, including members of the Baathists. They declared him a martyr of Iraq. We know that Ayatollah Al-Kui, throughout his life, was severely oppressed. In fact, they oppressed his family even after he passed away. His son, Sayyid Muhammad Taqi Al-Kui, happened to die in a car crash, which was well known as being organized by Sadr. If we look at the legacy of Ayatollah Al-Kui, first and foremost, his legacy is that he groomed, cultured, nurtured wonderful students all over the world. Students like Sayyid Ali Hussein al-Sistani, who is the marja for 450 million today. Students like Sayyid Mohsani, who has built a Najaf, a Hoza in Qom, which is bringing our scholar, a Hoza in Afghanistan, which is bringing so many scholars and so many new alims into the religion. His works. He had excellent developments in the work of Ilmu Rijal and Usul and produced over 90 works despite all the oppression, all the events that took place. Thirdly, his legacy is the protection, the maintenance of the Hoza in Najaf. During Ayatollah Al-Hakim's time and before him, the British Empire wanted to get rid of the Najaf Hoza. The Baathists want to get rid of the Najaf Hoza. But Ayatollah Al-Kui sacrificed so much. As we said, Ayatollah Ishaq Fayaz today says that the progress of Najaf is to the benefit of the soul of Ayatollah Al-Kui. Ayatollah Al-Kui understood the critical importance of the Hoza in Najaf to us today. And lastly, outreach. He built on the work of Ayatollah Mohsin al-Hakim to build Husseiniyas and Imambaras around the world. He personally developed the Kui Foundation, and he built up centers under his direction in India, in London, in Jamaica, in Pakistan. And he also supported a lot of causes throughout the world. Sayyid Maulana Rizvi used to say that Bilal, Kenya, was given so much benefit from Ayatollah Al-Kui, not only moral support, but financial support as well. The next thing we will look at is the life of Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. In front of you there, you have the family tree of the Sadr family. If we look at Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, his sister is Amina Haider al-Sadr. She was a very famous writer who used the name Bint al-Huda. So for the rest of the discussion, we will call her Bint al-Huda. Their father was Grand Ayatollah Ismail al-Sadr, and his grandfather was Grand Ayatollah Sadruddin al-Saleh. We won't have much time today to talk about Ayatollah Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr, whose photo here is to the bottom left. But he too was heavily oppressed by Sadr. He was quite a strong scholar. He wrote very good work in a number of areas, including on human rights. I think the Islamic perspective on the UN Declaration of Human Rights is quite interesting by him. And he was very much against the Baathist regime. He started to make the Shia feel that they needed to rise up. And as a result, he used to lead the Friday prayers in Masjid al-Kufa. In fact, so many threats were made against him that he used to wear it with a white shroud, ready and prepared to die. He was killed alongside two of his sons and shot after leaving prayers by Sadr. But the rest of the time today, we will discuss Ayatollah Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr. Ayatollah Muhammad Sadiq al-Sadr was an iconic intellectual and a man of very, very strong principles. He was born on the 1st of March, 1935, and he died on the 9th of April, 1980. He only lived 45 years. But today, if you speak to Iraqis, in their life, this man is etched into their hearts. He was a wonderful personality and a very, very strong intellectual. His sister Amina Bint al-Huda recalls, she says, "During our youth, my brother and I had very little money." This is when they were children. "We used to save whatever money we received so that Sayyid could buy a book. After he read it and studied it, Sayyid would return to the market and sell the book in order to buy another book with the money he received." Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr was very committed to learning about Islam. Although his family had been Ayatollahs, the actual family encouraged him not to take up the Hoza, but instead focus on professionalism where he could earn much money. One day his brother asked him to abandon studying about Islam and maybe do it later on in his life. He was only aged 11. And his reply was outstanding. He said, "I'm satisfied with very small amount of food and very small amount of sustenance. But I cannot be satisfied with a very small amount of knowledge, so please leave me be." Actually, Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, as a child, was a child prodigy. By the age of 6, he started teaching others about Islam. By the age of 10, he was known as being a scholar. By the age of 25, he became a mujtahid. He was extremely bright. If you remember earlier, we spoke about Ayatollah Al-Kui's Dars-e-Kharij, which he held, in which he would discuss quite complicated matters. And it was very rare for someone to dare and argue against Ayatollah Al-Kui. But there was one young student, one young very sharp mind, who often spoke out and challenged Ayatollah Al-Kui. At one point, history records that Ayatollah Al-Kui said to him, "Why don't we continue the discussion later?" And this is why Ayatollah Sistani is there, Ayatollah Ishaq Fayaz is there. He said, "Why don't we continue the discussion later? Because only the two of us understand this level." So you can imagine the level of Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. There is some history about him and when he was born. The next one is on his works. Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr did some monumental work in a very short period of time. So for example, he wrote Iqtisaduna, which is our economics. He wrote Falsafatuna, our philosophy. And in both of these, he attacked communism and he attacked Western democracy, or what he called capitalist democracies. I won't go too much into his critiques of communism. But on capitalism, for example, he prophesized that capitalism will mean that wealth will be in the hands of very few. Interestingly, he says 1%, a statistic which is there now. He said few people will gain the control of governments and try to control the media and the resources. And he said capitalism will fail because the quality of life in the end won't be there. He also attacked communism and he proposed an Islamic economics, which I don't have the capacity to maybe explain today. But he was a very, very, very sharp individual. In Kuwait, at one point, there was a conference organized of scholars to look into the fact that a lot of Muslim business people and Muslim investors, particularly there from the oil businesses, were investing their investments into interest-saving bonds and in derivatives and that type of thing, which may not have been Islamic. So scholars from Saudi Arabia, from Medina were invited, scholars from Al-Azhar were invited, scholars from Lebanon were invited, and so was Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. But a lot of pressure came from the Saudi scholars to the Kuwaitis, and they told the Kuwaitis, don't invite the Rafidi, Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, and eventually his invitation was revoked. Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, it is said, was very, very upset at this. But anyway, he wrote a book on Islamic banking, interest-free Islamic banking, for this conference and dispatched it. And when the people at the conference, they heard all the talks and all the speeches and all the accounts, they compared it with the book sent by Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr. They said the book by Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr outweighed all the discussions held by all the other scholars. This is quite wonderful indeed. Imagine, Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr didn't even have a bank account. How would he have known how international banking worked? How would he have known how bonds work? How would he know how derivatives work? Yet when they invited bankers, they invited other scholars who may have been more familiar. It was the young Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr's work which outweighed this other work. It just shows us how baffling and intelligent our maraji really are. Same with his attacks on Karl Marx. Now the books on communism were written mainly in Russian and English. Arabic had very, very few books on communism. Yet Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr, when you study communism, gives one of the best critiques ever on the concept of communism. So Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr and all our maraji are highly, highly intelligent individuals. Not only was Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr a scholar, he was also a political activist. He profoundly was resistant to the Ba'athist oppression. He once said, and this became a catchphrase in Iraq, he once said, "If my little finger was a Ba'athist, I would cut it off." Ayatollah al-Sadr's belief in politics came under a concept which he wrote about called Khalifatul Ummah, which is not the same as the Wilayatul Faqih, but the idea means that leaders would be steadfast in the path of Allah, i.e. leaders, political leaders, should have taqwa. Saddam's oppression of him and his family, and in fact the Shia at the time, is unprecedented. Many people set up the Dawah family in 1957, and the young Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr became quite active in this. A lot of scholars in Najaf told him not to be too active, to make sure that there's a demarcation of the Najaf Hawza and the political work. And he then issued a fatwa arguing for a demarcation between his own work and the work of the Hosa, because he also wanted to protect the Hosa and make sure the Hosa is for all, regardless of political belief. Ayatollah Sadr started writing articles for the Dawah Party. It was called Risalatul Islamiyah in 1972, a year before the head of the Dawah Party, Saib al-Dakhil, disappeared. In 1972, Ayatollah Sadr was arrested, but he was quite ill, so they detained him in the Kufa hospital. In fact, time and time again, Ayatollah Muhammad Bakir Sadr has been arrested. In 1973, 74 or 75 leaders were arrested as well. And on the 1st of April 1980, Tariq Aziz, who was the Iraqi foreign minister, went to a university, and it just happened to be a bomb went off at the university, and they blamed the Shia activists. And then a funeral happened for the people who died, and again another bomb went off, and again they blamed the Shia activists. And this enraged Saddam, and Saddam took it out on the Sadr family. Now, Ayatollah Sadr has been in and out of Saddam's jails, and there is evidence that not only was he heavily beaten, he was also electrocuted on a number of occasions. He spent a lot of his life under house arrest. On the 5th of April 1980, he was arrested for the final time. The chief of security in Najaf came to his house, and he just said, "It is our responsibility, Sayyid Sadr, to take you back to Baghdad to meet with Saddam." This is only a little while after those bombings, in which Ayatollah Sadr is obviously not connected. Ayatollah Sadr asked, "Are you arresting me again?" And they said, no, Ayatollah Sadr, you'll be back in 1 or 2 days. But something in Ayatollah Sadr's heart made him realize this was his final goodbye. He said to them, he said to the chief of security and the people with him, he said, "Wait for me a while so that I can perform ghusl, so that I can change my clothes, and I can offer 2 rakat namaz of shukr." They told him, don't worry, don't do all this. You'll be back either tomorrow, maybe the day after. But Ayatollah Sadr said no. He performed his ghusl, he prayed the 2 rakat namaz, and then he started doing wida to his family members. He sits with his youngest daughter, he cradles her, puts her into his chest. She was only 15, and she was unable to bear it. As he's talking to her, she begins slapping her face, tearing her clothes. Ayatollah Sadr looked into her eyes and he said, "Oh my sweetheart, every human dies due to illness or in bed or for another reason, but Allah is the best. If I would not die at the hands of Saddam, then I would die because of illness or some other reason." He said, "Certainly the companions of Prophet Isa were crucified for their beliefs." He then turned to his elder daughter and he says to her, "I am pleased with what befalls me. So if this martyrdom will bear fruits even after 20 years, I am content with that." He then spoke to his wife and told her to return to Kadhimiyah if he didn't come back in 2 or 3 days. He then looked at his sister Bint al-Huda, who was crying. She had a Quran in her hands. He walked to her. He kissed her and gave her a hug. Ayatollah's mother, whenever Ayatollah Muhammad Bakir Sadr was arrested, she would go onto the roof and begin praying. And she went onto the roof and she recited Mafatihul Jinan, the dua, which is dua for a mother to take away tribulations from her son. She did Amale Ashura. Ayatollah Muhammad Bakir Sadr was blessed to have a sister of the stature of Amina, who was known as Bint al-Huda. She was actually an extraordinary scholar in her own right. She was born in 1938, 3 years younger than Ayatollah. She was encouraged to study by Muhammad Bakir Sadr, and she was taught by her mother. And later, Ayatollah Muhammad Bakir Sadr took time away from his own studies, away from leading dars, and actually teaching his sister. She studied grammar, logic, jurisprudence, history, philosophy, and she became known as a very recognized scholar. A lot of people, when they met Bint al-Huda, were impressed by her. One example is Dr. Bint al-Shati, who is a well-known Egyptian female author. She met Bint al-Huda, and she asked Bint al-Huda, "From which university did you graduate?" Bint al-Huda's reply is, "I am the graduate of our house's school." She set up a number of schools. She focused on educating women. She wrote a lot of poetry, a lot of articles. And slowly and slowly, she began holding majalis, which during the time of Saddam was something that was banned. 300 people would gather, 400 people would gather, 500 people would gather. She even allowed matham to occur, which was again something banned at the time of Saddam. She became a threat to the regime, and every time these people would gather, police patrol cars would be around on the side. She was, in her own right, a wonderful, wonderful scholar. The death of Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr and Ayatollah Bint al-Huda are very, very shocking, parts of which even unspeakable. One of Saddam's soldiers who was there at the time, witnessed things firsthand, wrote, he said, the guards brought in Sayyid al-Sadr to the intelligence department in chains. They beat him. Then Saddam came and said to him mockingly, what are you doing, Baqir? What are you doing? Do you intend to make a government? Saddam got a stick and began poking him aggressively. And he shouted to him, you are a foreigner. You are an alien from this land. Just for info, his family was originally from Lebanon. His grandfather was originally from Lebanon. Saddam was really angered further as Sayyid al-Sadr refused to back him. And he became in a rage. He told his soldiers to torture al-Sadr and to make sure he went through severe persecution. Not only electrocution and beating, but he set his beard alight. And worst of all, he made him watch while Bint al-Huda was being tortured, things that we cannot go into. One of Saddam's intelligence officers narrates about the torture of Bint al-Huda. He says Bint al-Huda was severely beaten. Blood was gushing from her head and her face. He said while this happened, she was reciting verses of the Quran. Then Saddam entered. And as he entered, she recited louder and louder. This enraged Saddam, and he personally beat her. Bint al-Huda was then brought into the room where her brother was. And she was brought in unconscious. When Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr saw this scene, he cried out to Saddam. He said, if you are a man, then untie me and let us have a duel. Saddam took a whip in response and started lashing Amina himself. Then he commanded his soldiers to cut a body part from her. Saddam then held a gun at Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr's head. And he said, make a fatwa. Make a fatwa now to prohibit people joining the Dawah party. And make another fatwa to tell people to join the Ba'athist party. Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr refused. Saddam yelled to him. He said, what kind of death do you want? Ayatollah Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr wrote, and the intelligent officer is narrating. He writes, I want to have a death. I want to be slaughtered, he says, like Hussein was slaughtered. This really, really infuriated Saddam. Saddam immediately commanded him to be shot. Sayyid Muhammad Baqir al-Sadr removed his turban. He was ready to be executed. And Saddam personally shot both of them. And then he left the room abusing them. Sometime later, Saddam was asked, why did you kill the woman as well? And his reply is outstanding. He replies, I did not want to commit the blunder which Yazid did by sparing Hussein Zainab. So Saddam is recognizing Zainab's amazing nature. He recognizes that it was Zainab who brought down Yazid. Saddam recognizes the revival in Islam is due to Zainab. You can see the inside of the mal'oon. But Bibi Zainab's life is incomparable. What she has seen, nobody has seen. That is why she's Ummul Masaid. Zainab is the one who heard from her brother about the slaps to her mother Fatima. Zainab is the one who saw firsthand the pain of her mother Fatima after the Prophet passed away. Zainab is the one who saw firsthand the ribs, the broken ribs of her mother, Bibi Fatima, after they pushed the door on her. Zainab is the one firsthand who saw Imam Ali with a crushed head. Zainab is the one firsthand who saw the condition of her brother Imam al-Hassan, drenched in poison. She is the one firsthand who witnessed and heard about the arrows on his janazah. Zainab is the one who saw firsthand the pain in Karbala. Zainab is the one who saw firsthand the bodies of her two sons, On and Muhammad. She saw firsthand the crushing on Qasim. She saw the sacrifice of Abul Fazl al-Abbas. She saw the suffering of Ali Akbar. Zainab is the one who carried baby Ali Asghar. Zainab is the one, unlike no other, who saw the enemies surround her body. Her body was covered in arrows. Imam Hussein was like a porcupine. Those who had spears through spears, those who had stones through stones. Zainab is the one firsthand who saw someone sit on the body of Imam Hussein and commit sins that shook the heavens and the earth. Zainab's sacrifice, her sorrow, her grief is incomparable, unimaginable, and unthinkable. Allah lanatullahi alal qawmi thalimi. I hope and pray that we have done justice in these two talks to Sheikh Tusi, Allama Hilli, and Allama Majlisi, and to Sayyid Abul Qasim Al-Kui, Sayyid Muhammad Sadiq Al-Sadr, and indeed to Ayatollah Sayyid Muhammad Bakir Al-Sadr, and to Bint Al-Huda. We pray to Allah subhanahu wa ta'ala to show us the right way, to help us protect our madhab, and to increase the life of our scholars, and lastly, to hasten the reappearance of our 12th Imam, Ajalallahu ta'ala, Faraj al-Sharif.